Dr. David Pilgrim is a museum curator at Ferris State University, but his collection is nothing like your typical museum.
We want to show how everyday objects were used as propaganda to support the racial hierarchy in the country.
The Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia is home to 14,000 mostly racist artifacts.
If we are to really understand our past, that means to understand all of our past, including the ugly parts.
Today, we're talking with David Pilgrim about how one Michigan museum uses objects of intolerance to teach tolerance, and about the future of the museum with an $18.5 million expansion. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. I want to start off at the beginning. For David, his fascination with racist memorabilia began at a young age.
Well, I grew up a multiracial, black-identified kid in Mobile, Alabama, right at the end of the Jim Crow period. And these pieces were everywhere. The first piece that I bought, I broke. It was at a kind of hybrid carnival flea market. And it was a Mammy salt and pepper shaker. It had to be cheap because I never had much money. And I bought it and I just threw it to the ground and broke it. I don't think it was a philosophical statement. I just didn't like it.
Just a decision of the moment.
Yeah. Just me being a kid who, you know, like I said, I just didn't like it. I didn't break the second piece or the third. I just, you know, these pieces were everywhere, even in the homes of African Americans. And of course, I grew up in a rigidly, thickly segregated part of Mobile. And so most of the pieces that I saw were in the homes of African Americans. I was just fascinated.
I have heard that, you know, some Black Americans feel like it's important to buy these things and just get them off the market, you know, get them out of circulation, maybe even destroy them. And I've heard other Black Americans who say, you know, this is what it is. And they want it around for that reason, you know, as a historical artifact. Which of those interpretations are you leaning toward?
I believe these pieces can be used to document the past. I went to a historically Black college, Jarvis Christian College in Hawkins, Texas, and my teachers used objects as teaching tools, and that's when I figured out that I could use them as teaching tools. So there's a bigger answer to your question, which is why do people collect these objects? Because there are millions of them, and there are literally tens of thousands of people who collect. And quite frankly, the biggest pool of people that collect these objects are folks who thought they could make money from them. Hmm.
Tell us about some of the items that are in the collection today, maybe some that stand out to you particularly.
Yeah, we have, you know, because we're receiving thousands of pieces each year from the public, which, by the way, it's really hard for me to not accept an object, even if it's unsolicited, because I spent my life as an obsessive collector. And right now, as we speak, I mean, it's probably been, even during COVID, it's probably been 2 years since we've had a day where some package did not arrive from somewhere around the world with one of these objects in it. Most of them are common everyday objects, and that fits our purpose well because we want to show how everyday objects were used as propaganda to support the racial hierarchy in the country. Mm-hmm. But we also receive some unusual objects. I mean, my favorite piece, if you would, is actually not a caricatured image of an African American or something with a racial slur in it. It's actually an ink pen that President Lyndon Baines Johnson used to sign the Voting Rights Act into law. So the Jim Crow Museum, yeah, most of the pieces in there are segregation-related, are caricatured images of African-Americans. But we also have a small section on African-American achievement in the civil rights movement. And quite frankly, one of the more difficult sections of the museum would be the section we have on contemporary pieces. So objects that defame, mock, and belittle President Obama, for example. Which does that with some of the old caricatures?
Would you mind describing one or two of them for us?
So we had, you know, T-shirts, I think they first started in 2007 or 2008, which portray President Obama as a monkey. We have objects which portray him as a witch doctor, as an Uncle Tom. In other words, if you think of the racial caricatures with the accompanying stereotypes that existed during the Jim Crow period, he's been pretty much displayed in all those ways in two and three dimensional objects.
And when people think about Jim Crow era memorabilia, they tend to go right to the idea of lawn jockeys with painted black faces or the salt and pepper shakers that you described. But this is very much a modern concern as well.
Absolutely. If you have a race-based incident that occurs in this country that receives any type of national attention, you will have two- and three-dimensional representations of that within a week or so. So you're going to have shooting targets with Trayvon Martin, where he's the target, or something similar with George Floyd. You know, it's an unfortunate truth that despite a great deal of progress in our country in terms of becoming a more democratic, egalitarian society, that some of those Jim Crow era attitudes, tastes, and values have morphed into this society, into the present. And quite frankly, over the last half decade or so, you know, I see and hear ideas reflected that remind me of what it was like growing up in Alabama when George Wallace was governor.
Would you say there was a turning point at which your thoughts sort of changed on why racist memorabilia needs to be preserved? What would you say to someone who might argue that these things should be destroyed and that no Black American, or for that matter, a white American, should ever have to see them?
Well, you know, Americans like happy history. We like the history that you can celebrate, right, with parades and in smug conversations. But if we are to really understand our past, that means to understand all of our past, including the ugly parts, in part because we live in a residue. Even if we were to ignore this part of our past, it would not change the fact that new racist objects and new caricatures, new stereotypes, and actual objects themselves are still being made.
As I mentioned, there was a big announcement in early July about an expansion at the museum. Can you explain the scope of the gift you received and how you received it?
Well, actually, we've received a number of gifts. We are in the process of building a new museum. We're still fundraising, but we've hired, you know, the exhibit designers, the architects, the engineers, the building constructors. We will be a two-story building in the front of the Ferris campus. We hope to be a national resource. I think we already are, but we want to bring people from all over the country and the world. Right now, we have, in our small facility, we have police officers and politicians and church groups and civic groups and civil rights groups and students and others, where we're trying to do the thing that many Americans don't want to do, and that's to have honest, intelligent dialogue, not yelling and screaming, but honest, intelligent dialogue about where we were as a nation, where we are as a nation, and where we hope to go. And so this new facility, you know, our motto is no check is too large. So, but we are heaven bent on building a facility which is a national resource and hope to have it completed in a couple years.
We need to take a break. In a minute, we're going to hear about what public reaction has been to the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. Stick around.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
I wonder what you've observed of folks' reactions when they come to the museum, and maybe if there are differences from what you see and hear from white folks and black folks when they come.
Well, one of my big fears years ago, even before we moved into our current facility in 2012, one of my big fears was that my elders, my African-American elders, would not approve, that they would not get it, that they would see us as a shrine mm-hmm. to racism instead of an anti-racism facility. And I'm pleased to report that that did not come to fruition. Most people get it. I used to say that the visitors, when they came to the museum, the most common experience was a kind of reflective sadness. I think that still occurs, but I think, especially over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, as we have entered this latest iteration of a social justice movement, that people are wanting to talk. And we have an advantage over most places in terms of dialoguing about race, race relations, and racism, which is when people come to us, they've already made the decision that they want to learn. They know that they're going to see things that are unpleasant, but they want to have the conversation.
Yeah. Are there things that you've learned through curating the museum about the visual context and about how to create the physical environment that makes that conversation possible?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, in a practical, programmatic level, we use something called visual thinking strategies, which is to ask people, what is it you see? And for me to shut up, for example, and not talk, but just to listen, and to have visitors listening to other visitors. So somebody standing in front of a kitchen full of Auntie Mama and similar objects, you know, that person may be reminded of good times spent with their family when they were a kid, whereas the person next to them may be thinking that this reminds them of the residue or vestiges of Jim Crow and enslavement. Creating a space where those two views and the people that hold them can dialogue, that's, if you forgive the pun, that's the stable genius of the museum.
Some people might look at a museum like this and say, what is it doing at Ferris State? Do you see advantages to doing the work that you do in a smaller town that's surrounded by a vast sea of rural whiteness?
Yeah, we get that a lot. That gives us an opportunity to talk about our founder, Woodbridge Ferris. You know, long before it was normative, he was a champion for racial justice. Actually, one of my colleagues and I, Franklin Hughes, just wrote a book called Haste to Rise, where we talk about how Woodbridge Ferris brought in 70 or so African-Americans from Virginia, from Hampton University, which at the time was Hampton Institute, and how they came to Ferris because they couldn't go to college down south. And among that group, Belfort Lawson, first African-American to win a case before the United States Supreme Court, Percival Prattis, first African-American to be admitted to the press galleries in Congress, and just dozens of outstanding people that helped shape this country. Well, that's our foundation. So that's my first answer to that. My second answer to that is the collection is at Ferris, quite frankly, because I was a sociology professor here, and it was my collection, and I used to bring objects to class and start using it with my students. And then the university initially gave me a small room and started working with other classes, and then it was open to the public and the like. So in a sense, it grew out of the fact that I was here. But I think it's also at Ferris because it was possible here. I'm positive that there are a lot of institutions in this country, including ones in urban areas, ones at historically black colleges and the like, that never would have had the courage, to be blunt, to have the courage to create a facility like this. And of course, with the internet, it really doesn't matter where you're located, because we are accessible to people from other parts of the world. So I think you can do good work anywhere. And I think we're doing good work here, and we're on the verge of doing great work.
Hearing you talk about this, there's been so much evolution in how we think about and talk about making space for Black students. And I guess even just how I constructed that sentence, you know, as if this were a situation of like a white academic world or a mainstream white society making space for Black people. Just how we think about how we study together, how we work together, and how we live together. And it feels like the conversation that you're asking people to have at the museum is a big part of that. What role do you see the museum playing in the future and as you go through this evolution of the physical space as America's dealing with all these tough questions?
I actually love that question, especially the part about fitting in with the way we do things here at Ferris. So we just got a social justice major at Ferris. You know, I would love that one day we have students coming from all over the country to take that major, in part because they knew that they would get a chance to learn from the resource that we call the Jim Crow Museum. And obviously, on our campus, you know, the students who benefit from that museum, you know, come from, you know, pharmacy, optometry, criminal justice, arts and sciences, all over the campus. But it also does that for other universities. It's kind of interesting. We've had a group from Kent State come to the museum every year up until COVID, every year that we've been open, and they drive here. We've had students come from Notre Dame. I mean, whole classrooms of students who come to the university to sit in the museum to learn. Again, I think we're going to do more of that. You know, I'm not afraid of difficult questions. I'm not afraid of difficult conversations. If anything, I'm afraid for our country when we don't have those conversations. Obviously, there are people who are ideologically so far in one direction or the other that conversation and discourse is difficult for them. But even in their cases, it's not impossible.
Dr. David Pilgrim is curator of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia at Ferris State University in Big Rapids. He is also that school's vice president for diversity, inclusion, and strategic initiatives. David, it's a real pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with the campaign, and we're looking forward to stopping in sometime soon.
Thank you very much.
And that's the Stateside podcast for today. I'm April Baer. The Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia has a virtual tour, and you can find that link in today's show notes. You can also listen to the full Stateside show at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's show was produced by Rachel Ishikawa with help from Mike Blank. Our theme music is by 14KT, additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.